DW, World in Progress. With Sarah Steffen.
Welcome to the show. I'm Sarah Steffen. This week we talk about digitalization, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and an uprising that changed history. Digital technologies such as mobile phones, apps, and drones can help farmers boost their yields and help curb post-harvest losses. We'll hear how it's done.
Those were tomatoes that were supposed to get spoiled because the farmer has no capacity to bring them to the market. But through a mobile phone or a digital platform, they're able to connect to the market.
And how the Stonewall Rebellion 50 years ago was a tipping point for the gay liberation movement in the U.S.
After Stonewall, things got a lot easier because people came out of the closet and were more visible. I met my spouse in 1967, so we were living upstate, about an hour upstate when Stonewall happened. And I just thought, oh, another thing with the cops. So it was a while before it started to occur to me and to a lot of people that this was a lot more serious.
All that and more. Stay tuned. It's estimated that over half of fresh fruits and vegetables produced in sub-Saharan Africa are lost or wasted. Nearly half of these losses happen during post-harvest handling and processing. Experts say digitalization could help curb these losses in a region where, according to the UN, close to 240 million people are suffering hunger. The Malabo Montpellier panel has just released a new report called Bite by Bite, Policy Innovation for Transforming Africa's Food System with Digital Technologies. They presented it this week in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. The panel is made up of a group of international agriculture experts who are working towards poverty reduction goals. I spoke with Noble Banada, professor and chair of the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Makerere University in Uganda. I started by asking him how digitalization can help tackle these post-harvest losses.
If you see what a mobile phone has done for farmers in Africa, is unbelievable. I'll give an example of tomatoes, a farmer growing tomatoes in a press in the hinterland. And this is also premised on the fact that, for example, mobile phone penetration in East Africa, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, you're talking about 95% penetration. Almost everybody has a mobile phone. So if you have a farmer Y in a village X somewhere in Africa, in the middle of nowhere, as long as they have a phone, they have access to market. For example, in most of East Africa now, you have information, not only East Africa, in most of Africa, you have information on about prices of the day in the market. So if I'm selling tomatoes, mangoes, I know at least that a kilo of tomatoes costs €1, for example, €1 in the market in Kampala. So if you came and said that you are buying, let's say, my kilo at 50 euro cents or 40, and you factor in transport, then that wouldn't be a bad deal. But initially, because there was no platform of reaching the farmers, that wasn't possible.
So, of course, it helps farmers to be better informed. But how does it cut down on post-harvest losses?
I'm able to negotiate a price, and then a truck will come and pick my produce from farm. Using that phone, they are able to track where I am. So they will say, for example, you'll buy my tomatoes, I'll say maybe €1, and someone say, I'll give you 50 euro cents a kilo. I say, fine, come and pick. Where are you? I'm in village X. I'll direct you by phone. You come and find where I am. You park on truck and go away. Those were tomatoes that were supposed to get spoiled because the farmer has no capacity to bring them to the market. But through a mobile phone or a digital platform, they're able to connect to the market.
So because they can actually access these platforms on their mobile phones, they know exactly what the price is, and they wouldn't be ripped off by middlemen anymore.
Yes. Yeah. And that's one example. Another very good example is the weather information, when to plant, when to plow, when it's going to rain. That is information that is on free platforms now in East Africa, in West Africa, in Southern Africa. The farmers are able to know when to plow.
The report also has suggestions to use digital technologies to raise productivity. I'm thinking about the Third Eye project in Mozambique, where drones help farmers determine when to irrigate their crops. What other best practice models do you recommend?
What I had in mind was the use of Internet of Things. For example, sensors are put in soils, for example, to determine the moisture content in soils. And you put another sensor in the open space to determine how much water is in the environment. And then based on those two sensors, then you are able to say now irrigate, because you have the crop needs. The data, the platform is able to tell you that now it's a good idea to irrigate.
Can rural small-scale farmers afford these technologies? How are they trained?
What happens is that in Africa, most governments have farmer extension programs that are funded by government. And then, of course, one of the other things that has happened in Africa recently is penetration of internet, not only internet, but also the internet fees of data has gone down. And the internet is becoming, I'm talking to you now from Africa, from the university network. I don't need to buy anything. I just log in my Skype and talk to you. This wasn't possible 5 years ago. Not only the physical infrastructure, but also the soft infrastructure has improved in Africa. And that has also made technology penetrate a bit faster and reliable.
I can see that with a mobile phone, but a drone obviously would be more expensive, right?
Yeah, but a drone is more expensive. But I will tell you now, in Kampala and even in villages now in Uganda, when I go to a village party, there is a drone up our head taking photos. You can be amazed how technology moves very fast.
But even in really rural areas?
Yeah, in rural areas, government is trying to improve a lot. Government is trying to improve a lot by providing infrastructure to support the, like, for example, I'll use the example of countries that I know, like in Rwanda and in Uganda. In the rural area, if you want to connect to electricity, it's free of charge. If your house doesn't have electricity, government connects electricity for you. This wasn't dreamt of 10 years ago. And you know that access to electricity means access to internet, means access to reduction on post-harvest losses. You are able to use a fridge. You are able to, you know, to have cold chain support. Those are the services that people need. So I think there are some very good stories in Rwanda, good stories in Senegal, good stories in Morocco, just as our report explains it.
Nobel Banada speaking to me about the potential of digitalization for Africa here on DW's World in Progress. After a short break, we'll talk about the digital divide and how to include women farmers. Your report also points out the issue of digital divide, that people in rural areas often don't have access to the same kinds of services than people in cities do. The so-called last mile infrastructure often simply isn't there. Isn't there the risk that people in rural areas who need these services the most are left behind?
Yeah, there is a huge risk. It's the same thing even in Europe, that if you are in an urban center, you, because of competition, and one of the things you should know, that these mobile phone platforms are mainly private sector driven. So the digital platforms, the competition is higher in urban centers, and that works in the interest of the customer. But in the rural area, you find that, for example, in a village X, you may find one network there or two networks that are not as strong as in the urban. Like in Kampala here, all the networks are strong and reliable. But if I went to my village where my father is born, maybe I'll have two or three networks there. So that divide is there. That's the truth. But at least we no longer have a place in East Africa that probably you may not make a phone call on your phone. I think that one is not there anymore, which is a very good development.
What about the issue of digital empowerment of women? Your report points out women in sub-Saharan Africa are less likely to have mobile phones and internet access.
Yes. The biggest number of farmers, the small-scale farmers in Africa, are women. So if you have technologies that don't benefit the women, you leave out the vast majority of the people in sub-Saharan Africa. So that's why our report is highlighting that, so that people are aware that women have a role to play, and they are the biggest majority. In most cases in Africa, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, you find men own the land, but the women are the farmers. So, and it varies from countries to country. So I think women, issues of land ownership, issues of digitalization, issues of technologies that are relevant and easily used by women also come into play. And that's what we talk about also in the report.
What do you hope for the future of digitalization for Africa?
I'm very optimistic about Africa because, one, Africa has the very young population. Our average is really very, we have very young people in Africa, and they are very enthusiastic about technology. If you look at the technology platforms, at the way people use technology, in Africa, for example, now, it's better you send a WhatsApp message to anyone and you'll get a response than an email. People have their WhatsApp, their phones ready to reply anytime. So I think the future is very bright. And of course, also Africa has an opportunity to leapfrog what others have done. We don't need to go through the whole cycle. We have the benefit of coming last. And I think also technology at which it is developing, I think Africa is at the right time. I think if we didn't have that, and I'll be frank with you, some of us probably wouldn't even have returned to our home countries. Because, I mean, we went to top universities, we got good grades, but we stay in Africa because we are optimistic.
That was Noble Banada talking to me from Kampala on Skype. Still to come, the Stonewall riots 50 years ago that sparked the gay rights movement in the U.S.
We were dancing with each other when we heard screams and hollering, and we thought it was another raid like every other raid, you know, line up girls, that's what they said. And we heard Gypsy, a drag queen, scream, "Don't touch me, my husband's a cop." And then we found out it wasn't that. They came in, they threw drugs on the floor, said, "Step on that, that's yours."
World in Progress, brought to you by DW, Germany's international broadcaster. More at dw.com.
While digital technologies undoubtedly have many positive aspects, there's also the other side of the coin, using digital technologies as a means of control. The most prominent example, China's social credit system and its notorious firewall. Governments elsewhere have also taken to shutting down internet access to control the flow of information. Most recently in Sudan, when security forces went on a killing spree in the capital Khartoum, and now in Myanmar, where mobile internet has been shut down for more than 1 million people. The UN has warned Myanmar's military could be committing human rights abuses in Rakhine and Chin State. People there are essentially cut off from the outside world, with no way of documenting violence, and call for help. Another often neglected aspect of digitalization is the need for raw materials. As more and more people use mobile phones, we need even more rare earth materials, such as cobalt. 60% of the world's cobalt supplies are mined in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The precious metal is used in many products and machines, including rechargeable batteries and e-cars. But large mining companies are driving out the population of entire villages. And then there are the dangerous illegal mines where it's often children who toil away in the tunnels. Linda Staude went to explore, and her report is presented by Kathleen Schuster.
Serge Nikumuzinga trudges through the tall grass behind his village. Just a few meters from the simple houses is a deep hole, completely overgrown with vegetation. The young man pushes the tall grass aside and exposes an unsecured shaft. A few large stones stick out from the crumbling walls, creating a precarious makeshift ladder at the entrance.
We mined cobalt here, but then we came across groundwater. So there's still cobalt down there, but it's too expensive to pump the water out.
The abandoned mini mine is 7 meters deep, relatively small compared to the other shafts here in the city of Kolwezi in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's not uncommon to find mines 20 or even 50 meters deep. They were all dug by the locals, and all of them are dangerous.
Of course, people die in these shafts. When you climb into the hole, sometimes the walls start to crumble, stones fall, and you can die.
In the near future, the cobalt here will be professionally mined, and Serge's village will have little choice but to leave to make way for the next big open cast mine. Cobalt is necessary for the production of rechargeable batteries, which power numerous everyday products, from electric cars to mobile phones to tablets. 60% of the world's cobalt supply is mined here in the Congo, and much of it is sourced from these countless, hand-dug, dangerous mines.
I have no other work. My brothers told me that I could make a lot of money in the mines, so that's how I started.
That's 15-year-old Arcel. For 2.5 years, he toiled in the mines until World Vision financed a project to train him as a welder. Florence Mambo works at the aid organization.
The project au début a identifié.
At the beginning of our project, we found nearly 10,000 children who were working in the mines at 9 different sites. Since then, we've helped 1,200 children leave.
Alphonse said he started mining cobalt at the age of 11.
My father was sick at the time and couldn't work. He wasn't happy about me going to the mines, but I had to if we wanted to survive. Since then, he's gotten better, and he's working in the mines again while I go to school.
Child labor is illegal in the DRC, and the major mining companies abide by this law. Special policemen are sent to areas where illegal mines are common, where they're supposed to enforce the law. But they're often corrupt, says 13-year-old Patricia.
If you give them money, they let you go into the mines. So I might give them 2,000 francs. Then if I earn 3,000 francs, I'll still have 1,000 left.
That's about €1.50, a minuscule amount of money. But some miners have still managed to make a small fortune. This dream of easy money, or a secure income at the very least, means more than 100,000 people have continued to risk their lives in the dangerous mini mines. Simply shutting them down is not a solution, explains Florence Mambou.
Interdire, oui. Mais quelle est l'autre alternance?
A ban seems like a good idea, yes. But what's the alternative? These parents have no other way to feed their children. And as long as that's the case, illegal cobalt mining will continue.
Kathleen Schuster with that report by Linda Stauder. When police came to raid a small gay bar in New York City 50 years ago, something unthinkable happened. The gay community fought back. The raid at the Stonewall Inn on June 28th in 1969 sparked a violent rebellion that lasted for several days. The Stonewall riots were a tipping point for gay rights and have been credited with spurring the U.S. gay rights movement. Kai Kleeman spoke to people from the Stonewall movement about their experiences back then and the state of LGBTQ rights under President Donald Trump. His report is presented by Ineke Mules.
We started throwing rocks and bottles and shaking police cars.
It's a night of turmoil. But these riots at the Stonewall Inn Bar and along Christopher Street in Manhattan, New York, mark a turning point, the beginning of change.
Historically, people think Stonewall is a thing that completely reversed the problems gay people were having. But it polarized the gay community into believing that they could fight back. That was the significant piece.
The year is 1969. It's a time when the World Health Organization still lists homosexuality as a disease. Under the so-called sodomy laws, gay sex was a criminal offense in the United States. Even in 1986, the US Supreme Court still ruled that these sodomy laws were constitutional and therefore could still be enforced by individual states. It's also a time when public service announcements are often aired on TV, further fueling society's misunderstanding and distrust of homosexuality.
What Jimmy didn't know was that Ralph was sick, a sickness that was not visible like smallpox, but no less dangerous and contagious, a sickness of the mind. You see, Ralph was a homosexual.
Fear of the police, of their neighbours, potential health consequences, and even eternal damnation shaped the lives of the LGBTQ community, like a constant game of hide and seek, except it's anything but fun. People are essentially denied their own identities. Some parents try to cure their children of what's believed to be an illness through the use of painful electric shock therapy.
A friend of mine, John, his mother gave him shock treatments and he wound up nuts. And, you know, they had to put him away because all those treatments actually drove him over the wall and because his mother was trying to cure him. Remember, in the 50s and 60s, gay life was a disease. If I touched you, you're going to be gay. If I hugged you, you're going to be gay.
50 years after the riots at Stonewall Inn, a story has emerged about the fight for equality and respect. A fight which reached a symbolic climax in this bar, when the police staged yet another raid on the night of June 28, 1969. Its patrons decided that enough was enough, and so the resistance began. Many of those police raids are burned into the memory of 77-year-old Lee Zevi. A born and bred New Yorker, she lived with her longtime girlfriend and later wife in upstate New York. They frequented lesbian bars in Manhattan. Today, Lee still works as a gestalt therapist and supports Identity House, a non-profit organisation she co-founded in 1971, which provides a counselling service for those struggling to come out. During the years around the Stonewall riots, Lee managed to avoid any confrontations with the police.
Actually, I was one of the lucky ones. I was never in a bar when it was raided.
But she heard all the stories about the cruel twists this relentless game of hide-and-seek could sometimes take.
Just before Stonewall, I was in a bar called the Duchess, and the bar nearby might have been the Stonewall, actually, or the Monster, one of the two. A young man from Argentina jumped out of a second-story window because there was a raid, and he got impaled on a fence and died. And it was things like that that were happening all the time.
June 28, 1969 was a Friday night. At the time, Stonewall Inn was especially popular with gay men and drag queens. Tree Sequoia has worked at the Stonewall Inn for nearly 50 years. He's now 80 years old and travels around the world telling stories from that important time in history.
We were dancing with each other when we heard screams and hollering. And we thought it was another raid like every other raid, you know, line up girls, that's what they said. And we heard Gypsy, a drag queen, scream, "Don't touch me, my husband's a cop." And then we found out it wasn't that. They came in, they threw drugs on the floor, said, "Step on that, that's yours." People said no. And then we noticed a neighborhood cop that was a real nice guy. He gave us the high sign and three of us snuck out behind him. We came outside. And we started joining the 25, 30 people, the 50 people, 100 people, 150. And then we started throwing rocks and bottles and shaking police cars. We broke the lock on the back of a paddy wagon. A paddy wagon is where they put about 30 people to arrest them. We broke the lock and everybody in the back of that one got out and ran around the neighborhood.
Lee Zevi says many people used to believe that gays and lesbians would suffer throughout their lives. Even gay characters in novels were only considered acceptable if they died in the end, usually by suicide. There weren't exactly many positive role models for those struggling to accept their identity.
They were terrified, not just self-confidence, they were terrified that they were going to be in the fires of hell or they were going to be, you know, kicked out and on the streets or they were going to suffer for life. And many people couldn't accept it and ended up feeling very depressed.
The park in front of the Stonewall Inn is little more than a green triangle with a few shrubs and benches. But now, whenever Tree Sequoia walks through the park on his way to work, he's actually walking through the Stonewall National Monument, the first ever US national monument dedicated to LGBTQ rights and history. Then US President Barack Obama even sent a video message from the White House to mark the occasion in 2016.
So this week, I'm designating the Stonewall National Monument as the newest addition to America's national park system. Stonewall will be our first national monument to tell the story of the struggle for LGBT rights.
But times have changed. After Obama came President Donald Trump. In April, Trump declared that transgender people were no longer allowed to serve in the military. The foreign ministry recently declared that US embassies are not allowed to hoist the rainbow flag, a symbol of LGBTQ pride, during Pride Month, which also commemorates the Stonewall riots. The US ambassador to Germany, a gay man himself, had proposed otherwise. But Vice President Mike Pence remains steadfast in the government's decision, as he told US TV network NBC.
On the flagpole of our American embassies, that one flag should fly, and that's the American flag.
Suzanne Goldberg is a law professor at New York's Columbia University. Just a day before our interview, she had given a lecture on the state of LGBTQ rights worldwide. Although the situation is generally improving, many countries still have a long way to go towards acceptance and equality.
We're seeing tremendous advantages. The marriage equality movement is booming, and we have more countries than ever before that recognize full marriage equality, including Taiwan as the first country in Asia. We also have more countries decriminalizing sodomy than we've ever seen before, including a decision just today from Botswana and a decision a couple of months ago from India. So these are enormous shifts. At the same time, there are still 70 countries in the world that criminalize intimate sexual relations between same-sex partners, seven that mandate the death penalty, and five more that would impose the death penalty under certain circumstances.
People like Tree Sequoia, who witnessed the Stonewall riots firsthand 50 years ago, are glad that times have changed for the LGBTQ community. But he knows intolerance will never disappear completely.
There's always going to be prejudice. 100 years from now, people are going to be taught to hate and dislike people from different nationalities or races. You'll never stop it, but it's getting less and less. In fact, when we're growing and growing and growing, eventually, you know, somebody said, what do they think of a gay president? I said, if he's a good president, yes.
Therapist Lee Zevi met her long-term partner around the time of the Stonewall riots. This watershed moment in LGBTQ history went a long way towards allowing her to freely live her life with the person she loved until the end.
After Stonewall, things got a lot easier because people came out of the closet and were more visible. I met my spouse in 1967, so we were living upstate, about an hour upstate when Stonewall happened. And I just thought, oh, another, you know, thing with the cops. So it was a while before it started to occur to me and to a lot of people that this was a lot more serious. And our relationship lasted 50 years, and she passed away 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And I haven't quite gotten used to it, and I'm not sure I ever will, not having someone that close to me.
Ineke Mules with that report by Kai Clement. And that's our show for this week. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress. You can also find us on iTunes or SoundCloud and check out DW Women on Facebook. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio, Iliane Gagliarducci, Christoph Grove, and me, Sarah Steffen. Bye for now.